in Cuba, say, or three or four states in northern Mexico. Less plausibly, they could open up the territories of Kansas and Nebraska, under the Act of 1854, to popular sovereignty, workable only if enough pro-slavery men could move in. Ambitions south of the border lingered through the late 1850s. The two U.S. senators from Mississippi, Jefferson Davis and Albert Gallatin Brown, openly pointed to Cuba and the Mexican states of Yucatan, San Luis Potosí, and Tamaulipas. When these alternatives stalled or unraveled in the late 1850s, secession or confrontation grew more likely. This Cook's tour of North-South rivalry should underscore why the political, religious, and cultural mobilizations preparatory to open combat in 1861 were steeped in such acrimony. Long-standing frustrations, hopes, and disdains were coming to a head. Among them, as we will see, were specific religious concerns, including divergent interpretations of what the Bible said about slavery. These helped to precipitate the Civil War, then infused its conduct on both sides with righteousness, a quality reheated after 1865 across a South subjected to military-backed reconstruction. With little exaggeration, these vitriolic clashes of scriptural interpretation and denominational fratricide could be called a hidden civil war. Most historians agree that the accumulated pre-war, wartime, and Reconstruction enmities polarized sectional memories, and with particular bitterness in the South. Because the intensities involved may ring false at first reading, multiple descriptions seem in order. To Samuel S. Hill, editor of the Encyclopedia of Religion in the South's response is singular in American history, religious and otherwise, and is seen quite clearly in its religious life. A region became a culture, constructively and defensively, creatively and reactively. Many interpreters of Southern history have penetrated the subject of the mythic South to tell us that the South is a function of the Civil War and its aftermath more than it is of the antebellum period. The Confederacy became immortal is the way that Robert Penn Warren expressed it. To North Carolina historian David Goldfield in Still Fighting the Civil War, it is this continuing historical consciousness, particularly how Southerners have interpreted the Civil War and Reconstruction and then implemented that vision, that has set the South apart from the rest of the nation, though not apart from the world. Paul Harvey, a historian of Southern religion, explained how white Southerners after the war created their own civil religion, featuring its own theology, myths, rituals, and saints. According to the tenets of Lost Cause theology, God's chosen people, white Southerners, had been baptized in the blood of suffering and thus had been chastened and purified. To sharpen regional sentiment, Southerners for generations used every opportunity and locale, from cemeteries, pulpits, and war memorials to parades and Confederate veterans events, to promote their interpretation come theology. Confederate memorials and statues spread even across border states that had sent more men to the northern armies than to the southern. Memory itself became a battlefield. Ever vigilant, the South kept muskets and remembrance at the ready through the first half of the 20th century, even while racial segregation in the South continued with the judicial and political acquiescence of the North. Then, in the civil rights debate of the 1950s and 1960s, the old racial and sectional mistrust burst into flames again, blazing across decades that pundits and scholars have called a second conflict or reconstruction. Goldfield's assertion that Dixie never stopped fighting is also apt. Ironically, when national observations of the Civil War centenary began in 1961, bland words from an official commission sought to put any unpleasantness in the past. Historians Maurice Isserman and Michael Kazin, in their book America Divided, The Civil War of the 1960s, recalled how the official brochure avoided the words Negro and slavery. Indeed, Civil War Centennial Commission Director Carl Betts had told one interviewer, "The story of the devotion and loyalty of Southern Negroes is one of the outstanding things of the Civil War. A lot of fine Negro people loved life as it was in the Old South." However, Only months after the centenary commemorations began, new racial clashes across the South put mass confrontation back in the headlines. In what one writer called the Battle of Oxford, Mississippi, and then in Montgomery and Birmingham. To its northern and southern supporters, wrote Isserman and Kazin, the civil rights movement was a second civil war, or a second reconstruction. To its southern opponents, it was a second war of northern aggression. Civil rights demonstrators in the South carried the stars and stripes on their marches. Counter-demonstrators waved the Confederate stars and bars. The wartime analogies still fascinate. In 1998, I moderated a 30th anniversary panel on 1968's significance that included conservative commentators Robert Novak and Patrick Buchanan, along with Jules Witkover, the author of The Year the Dream Died, Revisiting 1968 in America. Asked whether the 1960s had elements of a civil war, all three agreed it had. During the 1970s, two veterans of 60s activism on the left, Kirkpatrick Sale and Carl Oglesby, published the books Power Shift and The Yankee and Cowboy War, portraying the Dallas to Watergate period as a desperate struggle between the Yankees of the Northeastern establishment and the Sun Belt Cowboys of Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, John Connally, and Ronald Reagan. Attention to the South's importance was also growing. John Egerton, a Southern writer, began a new genre in 1974 with his book The Americanization of Dixie, The Southernization of America. Describing how Southern culture, especially populism and evangelical religion, was beginning to influence the rest of the country, Egerton argued that Billy Graham has taken the old-time religion of his native South out into the nation and the world. In doing so, he has firmly established himself as the single most influential figure in what can fairly be called the Southernization of American religion. 2 decades later, Peter Applebaum, a New York Times correspondent based in Atlanta, extended Egerton's thesis in Dixie Rising, 1996. He identified the Southern roots not just of country music, but of the nation's conservative tide, the salience of race in national politics, the rise of states' rights groups, and the spread of Southern Baptists into the North. Only the blind could look at America at the century's end, wrote Applebaum, and not see the fingerprint of the South on almost every aspect of the nation's soul. If the events of 1861 to 1865 have some of the characteristics of a Rorschach blot, so does the debate over the existence and longevity of any second Civil War. Before the 2004 election, former Ambassador Richard Holbrooke identified the lingering disagreement over Vietnam as such a war. Political commentator William Schneider perceived a deadlocked national politics, the roots of which go back to the Great Civil Rights War of the 1960s, a cultural civil war in which a new left and a new right emerged to challenge the country's post-World War II consensus. Electoral demographer Michael Barone hypothesized a civil war between the two ideological wings of the baby boom generation. Commentator George Will observed some years back, "So powerful are the energies let loose in the 60s that there cannot now be and may never be anything like a final summing up. After all, what is the final result of the Civil War? It is too soon to say." In 1986, a quartet of academics, anticipating tensions that have since grown, published a volume entitled Why the South Lost the Civil War. Part of their argument, though, was that in some respects the South did not lose the Civil War. Southerners eventually resolved the dissonance between the world as it was and the world as they had wanted it to be by securing enough of their war aims: state rights, white supremacy and honor, to permit them to claim their share of the victory. Obviously, the subsequent decades have been even more encouraging for Southerners. Indeed, Southerners have bred a new cultural and political phenomenon, neo-Confederates. This upsurge goes beyond mere nostalgia. In The Memory of the Civil War in American Culture, 2004, authors Alice Faz and Joan Waugh point out that the Civil War has never receded into the remote past in American life. The most momentous conflict in American history, it had a revolutionary social and political impact that continues to be felt today. The political firestorms of the 1980s and 1990s over the appropriateness of the Confederate battle flag flying over state houses in Georgia, Mississippi, and South Carolina, for instance, demonstrate how deeply meaningful Civil War symbols remain in politics, especially racial politics. As evidence, they add that the unveiling of Richmond's first and only statue of Abraham Lincoln in 2003 brought forth a bevy of protesters. Although supporters of the life-size bronze sculpture of Lincoln and his son Tad emphasized the statue's symbolism for reconciliation, neo-Confederates waved signs bearing the slogan, "Lincoln, wanted for war crimes." In 2002, two cultural geographers, Edward Sebesta and Ewan Haig, ventured onto some unusual terrain with an article titled "The U.S. Civil War as a Theological War: Confederate Christian Nationalism and the League of the South." During that war, a minority of Southern Presbyterian clergymen had insisted that the conflict was ultra-theological, a fight between Southern true Christianity and Yankee heresy. And this interpretation, still alive on the margins of Dixie culture, has been raised again, say the two authors. Activists grouped around the 9,000-member League of the South, the Institute for the Study of Southern Culture and History, the Sons of Confederate Veterans, the DixieNet website, and the Christian Reconstructionist Movement have reiterated the old verities in support of a new Confederacy. Largely mirroring the League of the South's 96 chapters, its proposed polity would include the 11 states of 1861 to 1865, plus Oklahoma, Missouri, Kentucky, and Maryland. Peripheral as these events may seem, they flesh out the image of a region still immersed in its own exceptionalism, often at loggerheads with the North and driven by a unique history toward self-justification and expansion. And a very important part of that compulsion is religious. The Civil War forge of Southern resurrection, redemption, and revival. If Southern memory is indeed haunted by God, to quote a favorite caution of Native sons and daughters, the sermons of Southern clergymen during the Civil War period were haunted by apparitions of Hebraic heroes, analogies, and Old Testament place names. Nehemiah and Moses, of course, as well as Josiah, king of Judah, Job and his burden of righteous suffering, and the inspirational secession of the Israelites from the Jewish nation under Rehoboam. From Montgomery to Richmond, few even half-plausible biblical analogies were left undrawn. As we have seen, the post-1865 embrace of the lost cause put a powerful imprint on the Southern culture and politics that ultimately marched triumphant into the 21st century. Little could the gaunt, aged Jefferson Davis released from prison in 1867 have guessed that in the 1990s Southern Baptists would dominate Washington, or that in 2002 a Republican Senate majority leader from Mississippi would publicly wax nostalgic about the segregationist Dixiecrat presidential campaign of 1948. Or for that matter, that a Republican Speaker of the House, Newt Gingrich, a one-time Pennsylvanian turned Georgian and Southern Baptist, would wind up as a historical novelist, crafting epics of Southern battle flags sweeping victorious across his state of birth. The intensity of Southern devotion to the literal Bible, steeped in the veneration of Iron Age Judea and Samaria, is another necessary realization. Since the emergence in the 1980s of the religious right and the Washington ascendancy of Southern Republican politicians, dozens of historians have pored through the churchly annals of the 1850s, 1860s, and 1870s, publishing their findings under a host of evocative titles. Gospel of Disunion, Religion and Separatism in the Antebellum South, 1993. Religion and the American Civil War, 1998. Still Fighting the Civil War, The American South and Southern History, 2002. Rebuilding Zion, The Religious Reconstruction of the South, 1863 to 1877, 1998. And Redeeming the South, Religious Cultures and Racial Identities Among Southern Baptists, 1865 to 1925, 1997. What these and other kindred volumes document is the story of a self-identified chosen people. for now at least, one more successful than most previous covenant makers, who simply wouldn't let themselves be beaten, religiously or politically. By the 1830s, as we have seen, evangelical Protestantism had won the soul count below the Mason-Dixon line. Repentance of sin, born-again conversion, and biblical inerrancy soon became regional foundations of faith. When Yankee abolitionists escalated their attacks on slavery, Southern clergymen marshaled their own scriptural defense, taken from Exodus 20-21, Matthew 10:24, Ephesians 6:5-6, and others, with passages from the Bible that acknowledged or even supported slaveholding. These biblical citations were frequently accompanied by dismissals of abolitionism as wickedness and heresy. This interpretive combat raised the religious stakes in both regions. As we have seen, the United States of the mid-19th century, from north to south, was arguably Christendom's most church-going nation, bristling with exceptionalist faith and millennial conviction. Thus, doctrinal disagreements helped to define regional distinctiveness. This folk geography fed the separatism that eventually shouted for secession. Historian Mitchell Snay parsed these events in his book, The Gospel of Disunion. The way Southern clerics understood the relationship between religion and politics is key to understanding the role of religion in the development of Southern separatism. They sanctified slavery with an elaborate scriptural justification of human bondage, a slave-holding ethic to guide the conduct of Christian masters, and a program to bring the gospel to the slaves. They transformed the meaning of the sectional controversy into a larger struggle between orthodoxy and infidelity. Through clarifying the boundaries between religion and sectional politics, Southern clergymen essentially translated the political conflict into religious terms. Similar language can be found in other volumes. As this disagreement over scripture festered, the three major U.S. Protestant denominations were pulled apart. An 1844 debate, joined over whether a slave-holding clergyman could become a Methodist bishop, split that church, then the nation's biggest, into two branches, largely along sectional lines. The Baptists followed suit in 1845, and the Presbyterians divided in two stages, 1837 and 1857. Following the schisms of 1844 and 1845, politicians such as Henry Clay and John C. Calhoun wondered, all too prophetically, how long Americans would share a political union when they were no longer willing to share religious pews. Before the war, citizens on both sides had proclaimed America to be God's vehicle for the redemption of mankind, glorifying the tale of biblical Israel and the post-independence United States as strikingly similar and analogous. However, once division came, according to chronicler Snay, the appeal to Old Testament history and the analogy between biblical Israel and the United States was far more prevalent in the writings of the Southern clergy during the secession crisis. Examining both Confederate and federal fast day sermons, he found only one explicit Northern invocation of God's new Israel, a theme common among Southerners. Southerners in particular identified with Israel because of their self-image as a more prayerful people than Northerners, and because they shared Israelites' consciousness of being the people of a beleaguered small nation surrounded by enemies. Scripture, the Confederate clergy advised, even justified secession. The Reverend Lucius Cuthbert Jr. of Aiken, South Carolina, reminded his flock that when Rehoboam placed heavy burdens upon his people, God sent Jeroboam to head the secession of the 10 tribes. The Central Presbyterian of Richmond elaborated that the dissolution of the Hebrew tribes came not as a sudden and abrupt schism, but as the inevitable result of these chafing and loosening causes that had been acting for years. In short, just like supposed Yankee provocation. Ministers also argued that if defensive war by Israel had been justifiable in the Bible, it must be justifiable again. Because of its theological weight, Scripture could not be abandoned when the Confederacy experienced disheartening reverses, as with the death of Stonewall Jackson in 1863 or Lee's defeat at Gettysburg. Searching again, Southerners opened their Bibles to different passages. In the words of James McPherson, Like Job, many Southerners concluded that God was testing their faith as a preparation for reformation and deliverance. As a Southern woman put it, "The Lord loveth whom he chasteneth." Besides, God's chosen people had been led into captivity before, by the Egyptians and Babylonians, only to eventually triumph. In still fighting the Civil War, David Goldfield concluded that Southerners not only accepted adversity, they wore it as a hair shirt of faith. As white evangelicals restored Southern pride and dignity, they convinced themselves that the war had been part of a grand design, as one minister noted in 1866. God is working out larger ends than those which concern us as a people. God controlled Southern history now, and as long as Southerners followed him, they and their region would achieve salvation. To reinforce their self-esteem, Southerners recast their lost war using half-truths and exaggerations. They had the best generals and soldiers, rarely beaten by equivalent forces. The Confederacy was defeated only because of the effectiveness of Washington's naval blockade and foreign politics, combined with the North's lopsided strength in manpower and industrial production. A memorial statue put up by the United Daughters of the Confederacy in 1909 bore the proud boast, "As at Thermopylae, the greater glory was to the vanquished." North Carolinian Goldfield observed, "The generic portraits of Confederate soldiers, wan and doomed, that graced white Southern homes in the decades after the war, resembled Jesus in gray." As medieval townspeople erected statues to the saints, scarcely a Southern town existed without a statue or memorial to the Confederate soldiers as a permanent reminder of the heroic conflict. A new gospel was being compiled. Only in recent years, according to historian Reed Mitchell, have researchers begun to peel away myth, querying the case for the greater religiosity and superiority of the Southern soldiery, with its self-reinforcing post-1865 disdain for supposed Northern foreign mercenaries, paid substitutes, and house-torching marauders. Another Southern historian, Charles Reagan Wilson, has detailed the foundations of the lost cause Southern civic religion, an architecture of Christian and Confederate symbols held together by the clergy's post-war theology that reconciled defeat with the will of God and Confederate righteousness. Self-deception or not, what actually happened and what Southerners thought happened ultimately became a single historical process, not unlike the Bible's own origins. In introducing their anthology, Religion and the American Civil War, historians Miller, Stout, and Wilson concluded, "Thus, in the mythology of lost cause, the Southerners became like the Israelites of the Old Testament. They remained God's people, who would enter the promised land if they kept his commandments and covenants, among which was fealty to their noble cause. Baptized in blood, the South would be redeemed if it kept faith and walked the old ways, which it determined to do." In the pantheon of Protestant chosen peoples, Southerners seem to have more than matched the Ulstermen and Afrikaners, whose fealty to territory, tribe, and covenant has claimed so much attention. Their edge derives from the comparative importance of the United States. By the early 21st century, avid Southerners could claim apparent redemption and seeming triumph in geopolitical power that utterly dwarfed that of Northern Ireland or South Africa. Whether this eased frustration or whetted ambition remains to be seen. Under its own interpretation, the South was redeemed by 1877 when the last Northern troops withdrew following the stalemated 1876 presidential election. Politics and religion both played vital roles. Politics because Northern public opinion became disheartened with Reconstruction, and the Republican White House had to broker an election compromise by agreeing to troop withdrawal, and religion because of the extraordinary anti-Reconstruction determination and persistence displayed by Southern Baptists, Methodists, and Presbyterians. Refusing to reunite with their erstwhile Northern co-religionists, they instead embraced and kept alive what can only be called Southern nationalism. Between 1865 and 1877, continuing Yankee ex-Confederate competition over Reconstruction below the Mason-Dixon line involved three principal constituencies: Southern white, Southern black, and Northern white, each holding strong beliefs. The ex-Confederate worldview, which took full control in 1877, merits recognition as an extraordinary venture in successful myth-making, but it is important to bring up Northern religious overreaching during and after the war. Zealous Northerners, who looked back on pre-war Southern secession from national church bodies as simply another dimension of Confederate sinfulness, sought to reconstruct the South's tainted churches along with its tainted politics and government. The fierce response of most Southern churchmen, in turn, rested on the adamant conviction that God still favored the South and its churches. Slavery as an institution and secession were not sinful, though most admitted that some abuses had existed in the practice of slavery. Since Northern denominations were hopelessly political and radical, the Southern denominations had a duty to preserve the gospel untainted. Moreover, because Northerners and freed people controlled much of the political and economic life of the Reconstruction South, Southern evangelicals had to maintain their churches as bastions of regional identity. Southern unwillingness to make any apology or compromise had been hardened by wartime excesses. In Rebuilding Zion, Daniel Stowell described how federal forces destroyed 26 Baptist churches in Virginia alone. Between 90 and 100 Presbyterian churches were seriously damaged or entirely destroyed throughout the South. Approximately one half of these were in the Synod of Virginia. All of the churches in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, Knoxville, Tennessee, and Fredericksburg, Virginia, were damaged or destroyed by federal armies. Other indignities included the so-called invasion of the South by Northern denominations, especially Methodists. They sought to take over church buildings and recruit local congregations, aided by federal War Department orders permitting seizure of Southern church properties. Even Lincoln had difficulty halting these practices. Angry memories, old and new, spurred white membership in the ex-Confederate Baptist, Methodist, and Presbyterian denominations. During the late 1860s and 1870s, by Stowell's calculations, these three churches experienced dramatic increases in membership, well in excess of overall white population growth. This provided a unique glimpse of how average white Southerners reacted to competing visions of religious reconstruction. New Sunday schools, seminaries, religious publications, and denominational colleges further supported the white conservative movement. By the mid-1870s, Northern denominations and missionaries looking to reconstruct Dixie religiously knew they faced defeat. In the contest for white Christians, by one assessment, the Southern churches won an overwhelming victory as they grew far more rapidly than the Northern churches proselytizing in the South. Recruitment by Northern denominations among whites was successful only in bitterly divided eastern Tennessee and another dozen counties elsewhere in southern Appalachia. Overall, the centrality of the religious factor suggests a second informal ballot conducted in church pews on whether Southern theopolitic would sustain its antebellum hold. By and large, the Southern clergy prevailed, effectively employing their pulpits, church media, and educational institutions. In the eyes of Southern true believers, a defeated country recast itself as a righteous republic. Northern pressures on behalf of freed people slackened. By 1875, Walt Whitman, the poet and wartime Lincoln supporter, had come to view racial relations through an essentially Southern lens. The black domination, he argued, but little above the beasts, viewed as a temporary, deserved punishment for their Southern whites' slavery and secession sins, may perhaps be admissible. But as a permanency, of course, is not to be considered for a minute. Critiques of the corruption in some Reconstruction governments that were imposed on the South likewise weakened national support, as did hostile depictions of the evils of Yankee money chasing and the Northern cities full of immigrants, crime, and tenements. As Southerners re-entered their unreconstructed churches and rejected the party of abolitionism and Reconstruction, ex-Confederates recaptured control of their state governments. Tennessee in 1869, Virginia in 1869, North Carolina in 1870, Georgia in 1871, Alabama and Arkansas in 1874, Mississippi in 1876, and Florida, South Carolina, and Louisiana in 1877. True believers compared the reprieve to the redemption God granted to Israel, an analogy infuriating to Northerners aware how much the outcome also owed to violence, lynchings, and the Ku Klux Klan. Historian Stowell has traced the terminology. White Southern evangelicals described the end of Reconstruction as a redemption, a term that evoked a sense of regaining control of their political destinies, which had for too long been in the hands of usurpers. This favorite euphemism of the white Democrats, as Kenneth M. Stamp described it, had distinctively religious overtones. Although the first usage of the term remains obscure, Southerners were employing it at least from the time that the first Southern state, Tennessee, was redeemed in 1869-70. After redemption, myth-making moved toward a mock zenith, which probably came in 1915, when a pro-Ku Klux Klan movie, D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, enjoyed a special showing in the White House. It reportedly gained praise from President Woodrow Wilson, who had attended Johns Hopkins University with the book's author, Thomas Dixon Jr. However, even critics of the Southern record, such as David Goldfield, cite the favored biblical analogies in their analyses without sarcasm, because that was how the majority of white Southerners spoke and thought, wrongly or otherwise. No one should be surprised, then, that Dixie has bred so many historians. It is said that when Southerners aren't going to church, they're cherishing old grudges, burnishing Civil War statues, or remembering something. The Southern Baptist Convention, in particular, has been shaped by what local people call the backward glance. The Southern Baptist Convention, State Church of the Ex-Confederacy? Normally, it would be presumptuous to single out one church in a region, but in today's South, there is no choice. The Southern Baptist Convention, its official name, not merely a reference to its annual meeting, is preeminent in the South, an 800-ton dinosaur in the parlor of American Protestantism, and over the last century, the fastest-growing major church in the United States. To read about the SBC is to experience an impressive flow of adjectives. Distinctive, unique, fundamentalist, missionary, independent, imperial, uncompromising. The church is also, as we will see in Chapter 6, the increasingly political institution that in the 1990s cemented the Republican hold on the South and kept the party positioned to win the White House. One description rarely ventured is mainline. To quote Richard Hutchison in Mainline Churches and the Evangelicals, the Southern Baptist Convention, the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod, and some of the major black Baptist groups are certainly large denominations with deep roots in American history, but they would be omitted from many mainline lists. Why? Because they are strongly conservative and are not part of the ecumenical movement. The SBC is also, in considerable part, populated by fundamentalists. Baptists in the South, however, have always been distinctive. At first, they shocked colonial-era Anglicans with their exuberance, physical convulsions, and adult baptism. Then more numerous Baptists annoyed the gentry of the new Southern states circa 1790 by their occasional biracialism, opposition to hierarchy, and disrespect for patriarchal authority. Thereupon, as we have seen, to gain community acceptance for their evangelical mission, denominational leaders made accommodations on prickly issues. By 1830, white Baptists who had questioned slavery in late 18th century Virginia were defending it as a divinely sanctioned social order. In place of frontier one-room meeting houses, Baptists in some towns opened colleges, ran newspapers, and built impressive churches, although too few to change the denomination's overwhelmingly rural nature. By rallying around regional culture, hierarchy, and slavery, antebellum Southern Baptists did alienate considerable numbers of co-religionists, mostly poor whites unsympathetic to urban fashion, schools, costly good works, and support for the local power structure. These discontented folk turned away to become the primitive and anti-mission Baptists of the Appalachian Upcountry and Texas Hills, so labeled because they opposed missionary efforts as middle class, expensive, and, by the Calvinist doctrine of predestination, a waste of time. According to the New Historical Atlas of Religion in America, 2001, these primitive or hard-shell Baptists grew to number a half million or so, white and black, by the end of the 20th century. Other small sects are numerous. Even in Dixie, many conservative white Baptists belong to denominations less fashionable or sophisticated than the SBC. As noted earlier, the National Baptist movement of the mid-19th century seethed with sectionalism. In 1845, after Northern Baptists told Southern compatriots that Yankeedom could never be a party to any arrangement that would imply approbation of slavery, irate Southerners decamped to Augusta, Georgia. There, eight states led by Virginia formed their own regional bloc, the Southern Baptist Convention, which from the start wore its regionalism with pride. A century and a half later, the SBC would be the only American Protestant denomination to still retain the word Southern in its name, a badge of its origins and commitment. Antebellum Northern and Southern Baptists differed over more than slavery. Despite alliances with the local establishment, those in the South tended to be of lower social and economic status, exhibited much less interest in an educated ministry, and extended westward by means of farmer preachers. Northern Baptists, by contrast, tended to be middle class, tended to think in terms of an educated ministry, and expanded westward by way of missionaries. After war broke out in 1861, a flag-waving SBC inundated the Confederate Army with uplifting pamphlets. One such, entitled A Mother's Parting Words to Her Soldier Boy, penned by Jeremiah Jeter, a Virginia newspaper editor and Baptist minister, supposedly was the most popular single piece of religious literature in Confederate camps, with more than 250,000 copies handed out. By 1864, Baptists had provided the Southern Army with more than 100 different tracts, totaling some 50 million pages, while also vending Bibles, hymnals, and religious miscellany. Not long after the war, Baptists in Virginia preened that the history of the world, we presume, reports no instance of an army so thoroughly under the influence of the gospel as was our noble Southern Army. When Reconstruction followed, the Southern Baptist Convention remobilized, despite wrecked churches, impoverished congregations, and lack of funds. These years put a strong psychological imprint on its future as well as the region's, akin to the intense Boer experience with the Great Trek and Ulster Protestant immersion in the do-or-die confrontations of the late 17th century. No other religious subculture in the United States bears any similar stamp. To religious historian Paul Harvey, white Baptists viewed political and religious reconstruction as the same process in different institutional settings, and from the start, prominent Virginia Baptists portrayed white Southerners as victims of Northern marauders. In Georgia, federal troops shut down the Christian Index and Southwestern Baptist for its advocacy of disloyalty as a moral and religious duty of the white South. Moreover, churches expressing sympathy for the Union or for Republicans found themselves booted out of Baptist associations and other religious organizations. By reiterating pre-war views, including Dixie righteousness and black incapacity for self-government, the SBC pitched a popular tent. In Rebuilding Zion, Daniel Stowell concluded that the speedy restoration of Southern denominational institutions and religious newspapers gave Confederate Christians a distinct advantage over Northern missionaries who came South seeking Unionists and penitent rebels. Southern ministers preached a different version of God's purposes in the war, and once denominational mechanisms were again in working order, Southern churches began to receive thousands of new members. Denominational periodicals zealously guarded against laxity among Southern Christians and mercilessly attacked Northern denominations and their missionaries. By the 1870s, according to Stowell, Southern churches were virtually bereft of black members, and many of those members had joined Northern biracial denominations. Although they continually voiced their commitment to black evangelization, Southern Baptists refused to allow blacks the full privileges of membership. The ultimate irony is that separate, black-controlled Baptist congregations thrived, providing training grounds for self-government, through which black Baptists attained an equal or greater depth of religious and political commitment that was to serve them well in the civil rights struggle a century later. Not surprisingly, the post-bellum legacies of white Southern separatism and ecclesiastical warfare all but ruled out a reunion with Northern Baptists. For the SBC, sectional feeling and theology blended into a sense of holy separation, a commitment to remain free of Northern contamination because Southern religion was more virtuous and biblically sound. One North Carolinian put matters bluntly in 1899, "We are a different people, a different blood, a different climate, a different character, different customs, and we have largely a different work to do in this world." By the late 19th century, according to Miller, Stout, and Wilson, ministers with the Southern Baptist Convention controlled much of the religious life of their region. They had grown in numbers after the war, and despite the individual poverty of many congregations, by sheer numbers they had consolidated a hegemonic position within the South. A growing racial consensus among whites North and South allowed Southern whites to manage their own race relations, and Southern Baptists participated fully in mythologizing the lost cause. Southern Baptist ministers were now leading cultural figures throughout the South. After it became clear that Baptists could not reunite nationally, the two camps did manage to agree on who would operate where. The Southern Baptist Convention, increasingly expansion-minded, got its requisite franchise, first to control missionary work in the South, then after an 1894 agreement to proselytize in the West. In 1895, the separate all-black National Baptist Convention, ultimately to become the nation's second-largest Baptist denomination, was organized as the culmination of 3 decades of work toward self-government. During this same period, while other large denominations lost members to Pentecostal and Holiness sects, the SBC did not. Predominantly rural, lost cause dedicated, unsophisticated, revivalist, and evangelical, but not yet fundamentalist, the turn of the century SBC gained from populist and revivalist currents. Membership in convention-affiliated churches reached just over 1 million in the early 1870s, rising to nearly 2 million in 1910 and 3 million by 1920. One observer noted that while to this day there are Evangelical Presbyterian denominations, EPC, an Evangelical Methodist denomination, EMC, and 2 Evangelical Lutheran denominations, ELCA, EL Synod, there is no Evangelical Baptist Church. Beginning during this era, 1890 to 1910, Southern Baptists made the term redundant. With little to dilute its appeal, the SBC consolidated strength in the ex-Confederacy, aided by its post-war role as a bulwark of sectional identity and its unique mixture of biblical conservatism and revivalism. Between 1870 and 1916, according to the New Historical Atlas of Religion in America, the number of counties in Virginia, Kentucky, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Texas in which Baptists of all kinds predominated over any other denomination doubled or tripled. More than half of the counties marked as having Methodist or Presbyterian margins in 1870 were converted, and by World War I, only a few ex-Confederate states retained significant clumps of Methodist counties. By 1910, as revivals filled SBC pews, some 40% of white Southern churchgoers and 60% of black Southern churchgoers were Baptists, for a total of some 5 million. The Southern Baptist Convention became the nation's largest Protestant denomination, while the National Baptist Convention took pride in identifying itself as the largest black religious organization in the world. However, big as the SBC had become, it was still the church of the plain folk, country South. Some 80% of Baptist church members were farmers, 35% of them tenants. And as late as the 1920s, some 86% of the SBC-affiliated churches stood in rural areas. Of congregations with meeting houses, 85% met in cabin-like one-room structures. Substantial SBC congregations were uncommon outside city limits. This helps to explain why, in the first quarter of the 20th century, the fast-growing congregations of the Southern Baptist Convention became important nurseries of American fundamentalism. The scriptural crisis surrounding the Civil War had nurtured biblical literalism. The 1890s had seen a re-emphasis on revivalism, and in the decade after World War I, a conservative and biblical counter-reaction to the culture shock of radio, automobiles, short skirts, and the jazz age was unleashed. For the SBC, venting cultural anti-modernism was as comfortable as Br'er Rabbit found the briar patch. Southern Baptists, as we have seen, were front and center in drafting the fundamentals. The 1910 to 1915 compilations that soon gave fundamentalism its name. But if the SBC still prioritized winning souls and sought to eschew political stumping, it did not entirely succeed. The convention was at the fore during the 1920s in promoting prohibition and in helping the anti-evolution movement to convince state legislatures to ban the teaching of Darwinian theory in Oklahoma, Florida, North Carolina, Texas, Tennessee, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Arkansas. Many annals of the 20s hold that Southern fundamentalists and Pentecostals, embarrassed by national ridicule, faded back into Appalachian hollows or coastal piney woods. But as we have seen, they did not retreat in numbers. Their network of seminaries, Bible fellowships, and radio gospel hours expanded, enabling them later to re-enter the national stage with considerable muscle. At mid-century, SBC conservatism, satisfaction with the cultural status quo, well flavored with patriotism and anti-communism, rested comfortably on a theological framework that remained essentially evangelical and mission-minded. From 1940 to 1960, in decades when segregation and civil rights demonstrations were roiling the South, the SBC saw the number of its adherents nearly double, from just over 5 million to just under 10 million. The significant expansion brought by these gains in northern and western states will be pursued shortly. These SBC missionary achievements, moreover, took place while more staid northern Baptists, shorn of fundamentalists who split off in the 1930s and again in the 1940s, underwent decline. On racial issues specifically, the SBC of the 1950s cannot fairly be caricatured because in 1954, its Christian Life Commission disregarded political and white congregation sentiment to issue an endorsement of the Supreme Court's Brown v. Board of Education school desegregation decision. Many, if not most, white Southern Baptists would have disagreed, but the SBC colleges and seminaries had an influential progressive element. Still, the interplay of culture, biblical inerrancy, and racial circumstances during the 1960s began to move the SBC toward the aggressive political conservatism it would embrace in 1979 with the election of a new presiding officer and then entrenched during the 1980s. For decades, the leadership of the convention, men who eschewed open politicking in favor of bringing converts to Jesus and saving souls, had cut some slack to moderates on social themes to keep the internal peace. The 60s and 70s, however, saw that truce crumble as moderates and liberals in the SBC infrastructure of agencies and commissions pushed increasingly controversial positions. Disagreement over evolution and racial desegregation stood out. Convention theologian Ralph Elliott's book, The Message of Genesis, 1961, doubting the existence of Adam and Eve and questioning Jonah's survival in the whale, caused a ruckus. So did the moderate faction's orchestration of the SBC's 1968 statement concerning the crisis in our nation, a call for social action in race relations and anti-poverty efforts, which included a confession of complicity in the injustice done to blacks. To opponents, such controversies got in the way of the SBC's primary mission, spreading the gospel. Not a few conservatives became convinced of the need to regain organizational control. In his 1997 book, The Rise of Baptist Republicanism, South Carolina conservative Orrin Smith contended that by the 1970s, the gospel-spreading priority had supplanted attention to policy. What began simply as natural brand loyalty and confidence evolved into a dangerous hubris, and out of church-building megalomania and a creeping belief that the SBC had a particular divine mission, came a certain presumption. One moderate leader suggested that in the 1950s through the 1970s, the SBC reflected the culture. Baptists were in denial. They wanted peace, not admonition. The attitude was, anything that takes away from building the church is anathema. In fact, SBC statistics showed its membership share peaking among whites in half of the ex-Confederate states in 1960, then losing a little ground by 1970 and more by 1980. Controversy may have taken some toll. As SBC affiliation peaked in the southeastern states where Baptist momentum reached back to 18th century evangelism, but where Northerners were now moving in, convention missionaries recorded better 1960 to 1990 results in the South Central and border states: Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, Oklahoma, Missouri, Tennessee, and Kentucky. There, SBC ratios either expanded or stabilized. That the biggest strides came in Oklahoma and Missouri reflected another trend with notable political implications: how Southern Baptist expansion was moving north and west, albeit most pronouncedly in areas of original Southern settlement or later migration from the former Confederacy. Beyond the Civil War border states, the National Church Membership Survey for 1990 found impressive increments for the SBC in Southern Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, southeastern Kansas, and eastern New Mexico, as well as in scattered rural counties in Nevada, Colorado, Wyoming, and Idaho. 40 years earlier, Southern Baptists had not led other Protestant denominations in a single county in Ohio, Kansas, Nevada, or Wyoming. By 1990, they led in 17 such counties. As we will see in Chapter 6, this expansion became a major benefit to the Republican Party as its leadership southernized and took up a de facto political partnership with the SBC. The Texans who led the conservative takeover of the convention were initially aroused by, of all things, the supposed modernism creeping into Old Testament classes at Baptist-supported Baylor University in Waco. After consultations, they developed a plan to take over the SBC presidency at the 1979 annual meeting and employ that office to appoint true believers to the SBC's quasi-independent agencies, boards, and commissions. By the late 1980s, after 10 years of conservative appointments had remade the bureaucracy, the 18-million-member Church of the Southern Cultural Memory was on its way to becoming a newly-fledged Church of Biblical Inerrancy and Republican Ascendancy, an extraordinary metamorphosis full of national and even global implications. Before we shift to the Church's political heft, two aspects of this portrait require further clarifying brushstrokes. First, can the SBC of the late 20th and early 21st centuries be fairly described as fundamentalist, given the pejorative and anti-modern implications of that dour image? And second, more portentously, can the Southern Baptist Convention be considered the de facto church of the South, the closest approximation to an official church in the United States since the disestablishment of Congregationalism in New England almost two centuries ago? Historically, fundamentalism referred to those 20th-century American Protestants who reacted negatively to science and acted militantly against any reading of the Bible other than a wooden, literal meaning, contends Robert Parham, director of the Baptist Center for Ethics in Nashville. Today, fundamentalism is a description applied to militant extremists who demand that others embrace their way or hit the highway. Clearly, there is disagreement over this, and practically speaking, the definition is in flux. Nevertheless, the majority view among religious scholars is that yes, the term fundamentalist does fit the latter-day SBC viewpoint. Witness the comments of prominent figures such as Martin Marty, Scott Appleby, and Charles Kimball. The dissident moderate faction of Southern Baptists, based in organizations such as the Alliance of Southern Baptists and the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, routinely and unhesitatingly labels the controlling conservatives fundamentalists. Self-proclaimed fundamentalist Jerry Falwell saluted the SBC in his co-edited history, The Fundamentalist Phenomenon. In The Rise of Baptist Republicanism, Orrin Smith, after loosely locating evangelical religion between mainline belief and fundamentalism to the right, concluded that the SBC was already on the rightward fringe of evangelicalism during the 60s and 70s, slipping into overt fundamentalism after its conservative faction took over in 1979. Political chronicler Smith took his criteria from Defenders of God, the Fundamentalist Revolt Against the Modern Age, 1989, a comparative study of religions and cultures by Bruce Lawrence, a prominent Duke University theologian. Lawrence's main yardsticks: creedal belief, scripture as the fount of legitimacy and ideology, an attraction to charismatic leaders and preachers, self-perceptions of embattled purity and righteousness, tendencies toward opposition and separatism, and domination by male elites, all seem to apply to the SBC. There is no doubt about its reliance on scripture, biblical inerrancy, disdain for ecumenicalism, and refusal to let women serve in positions of authority. The quibble, ironically, comes from the fringe right. South Carolina's separatist fundamentalists, centered at Bob Jones University, reserve true fundamentalism for themselves. They reject the SBC as too ecumenical and doctrinally impure. Theological beauty is also apparently in the eye of the beholder. The case for the Southern Baptist Convention as a sort of state or established church of the South, touched upon at least by many regional historians, may seem far-fetched given its fundamentalism. However, the two are not necessarily incompatible. Most characterizations of the SBC identify it, quite plausibly, as a folk church determined to keep its relationship with Southern farmers and country people. Religious historians have also profiled a commitment to scripture and sacred territory and a past of upholding and intensifying Confederate identity, comforting fighting men in the field, and serving after the war as a keeper of the flame of myth and history. This could fittingly be called quasi-nationalism. Indeed, these past identities also uphold the considerable analogy to the covenanting God and the biblical pre-fundamentalist churches of the other New Israels. All were actual or de facto state churches. In the 16th and 17th century Netherlands, the Dutch Reformed Church, and then the successor Dutch Reformed Church of 19th and 20th century South Africa. For Ulster, its pair of combative ancestral kirks, the Reformation Presbyterian Church of Scotland and its heir, the Presbyterian Kirk in Northern Ireland, the de facto church of the Scottish settlers. To extend the parallel, the heavy Scotch-Irish influence on the 18th and 19th century South is well documented. U.S. historian George Frederickson, a Civil War expert, has also found some similarity between how Southerners and Afrikaners experienced frontier circumstances and racial tensions. The partial SBC parallel to the circumstances and churches of other covenanting peoples deserves some attention in its own right. To chronicler Smith, the most evident feature of Southern Baptists is their very Southernness, along with their role in the South's folk religion, a case also framed by Southern Baptist academician Norman Vance in Religion Southern Style. Baptist exceptionalism, in turn, thrives on the evangelical link between cultural domination and pursuit of membership growth. Eventually, the notion of a Christian or even Baptist region becomes a civic religion, a mentality so binding that Southern Baptists begin to think of themselves as the cultural majority with the goal not of rejecting society, as some small, sect-like religious conservatives have done, but of absorbing it. In such a world, Baptist clergy and lay leadership have no interest in taking stands against Southern cultural norms. They are not motivated to oppose the culture or appear unpatriotic about the region, for to a greater and greater extent, they are the culture. They are the region. In 1996, they were also the nation, or at least the nation's Washington leadership. The President, Vice President, Senate President Pro Tem, and Speaker of the House were all Southern Baptists, an absolutely unprecedented foursome that would have stunned the 18th and 19th century Southern-born presidents who were Episcopalians or Presbyterians. Baptists were not the Southern leadership class. In 1861, the president of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis, was an Episcopalian. In a sense, this was Washington's second upheaval during the 1990s. But surprisingly little attention was paid to the regional role of the church, to which Bill Clinton, Albert Gore, Strom Thurmond, and Newt Gingrich all belonged. Few descriptions of the SBC go beyond historians' acknowledgments or explanations of how it is unique in success and folk regionalism, distinctive, huge, fundamentalist, and biblical, independent, opposed to ecumenicalism, separate, a sense of apartness, expansionist, missionary and territorial, and a keeper of the regional and cultural flame, steeped in Southern history and memory. But these characteristics do seem to combine in a way that bespeaks the greater role that the SBC has played. The Greater South and the Future of the Republic. The Confederacy defeated in the Civil War was only the heart of a larger cultural or geographic region that geographers circa 1860 could fairly have mapped as Southern. Before the 11 Confederate states could be subdued by the wealthier, more entrepreneurial and industrial North, the Lincoln administration had to contain a potentially larger rebellion. From downstate Delaware to Missouri to Southern California, portions of the Greater South decided against secession or were blocked from attempting it. For some 18 months in 1861 and 1862, the federal government critically improved its odds for victory by 1. Applying military power to keep the border areas of Maryland, Western Virginia, Kentucky, and Missouri in the Union. 2. Supporting local Republican politicians in the 1862 elections, in which voters in southern settled sections of Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois gave the Democrats congressional gains and in two states nearly captured governorships that might have shut down war commitment. 3. Blocking a Confederate invasion of what is now New Mexico and Arizona by a Texas column aiming for California, with a military victory at La Glorieta Pass in March 1862. And 4, suppressing secessionist sentiment and activities by Southern sympathizers in California and Oregon, as well as in mining camps from Nevada and Idaho east to Colorado. By 1863 and 1864, with these problems relatively contained, federal forces were able to take the offensive in Confederate territory, and even then, victory was long in doubt. Lincoln himself was worried well into the summer of 1864. While the ups and downs of 1861 and 1862 may be of interest to armchair generals, for the purposes of this chapter, and for 21st century political strategy, suffice it to say that the Greater South, united against Yankeedom, might have won back then. Today's Greater South, in turn, deploys an even larger share of the nation's population and political and economic power. There are maps that are attempts to portray the boundaries of the cultural Greater South, one by geographer Raymond Gaskill and the other by sociologist John Shelton Reed. The first is Gaskill's portrait based on cultural and linguistic regions. The second, by Reed. His other boundary criteria, not entirely serious, have ranged from kudzu to outdoor toilets to the states and cities mentioned in country music hits, represents an unusual departure. In it, he maps the locales where people perceive themselves to be Southern, based on the ratio of telephone directory business listings that begin with Southern as opposed to American. Like Gaskill's, this map takes the South into Kansas and the Ohio Valley, while also nudging into Pennsylvania. Instructive as these contours may be, though, even they fail to measure the considerable Southern cultural and religious influence through both the Midwest and West. The Ohio Valley portions of Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, well understood to have been settled from the South and border states, are hardly the only Southern cultural outliers. A fuller look at the extended 1861 to 1865 geography of secessionist sentiment and Confederate flag waving is a necessary but still only preliminary introduction to the reach of the present-day Southern coalition. Both of the two western states newly admitted to the Union, California, 1850, and Oregon, 1859, had substantial southern and secessionist populations. Abraham Lincoln later admitted that his pair of narrow victories there had come by the closest bookkeeping that I know of. Oregon, settled by Yankees in Portland and the nearby Willamette Valley, also had southerners and border staters in its southwest, central, and northeastern counties, enough to briefly hatch a plan for an independent slaveholding republic under Oregon's southern-born senator, Joseph Lane. Lincoln barely won in 1860, taking 36% of the votes to 34% for John C. Breckinridge, the Southern Democrat, and 28% for Stephen Douglas, the Northern Democrat. Many pro-secessionists had traveled west from Missouri, the jumping-off point for the 2,100-mile Oregon Trail. In California, the population center of San Francisco was Yankee-dominated, while Southern and secessionist elements clustered in the thinly populated Los Angeles area, in the Central Valley, and in 49er mining districts. South Carolina Palmetto banners and Confederate flags flew in Stockton, San Jose, Visalia, Santa Barbara, San Bernardino, and Los Angeles. More tangibly, proposals were made for reinstituting the Bear Republic of the 1840s or for launching a new Pacific Republic including California and Oregon. And a short-lived training camp for Confederate recruits was set up in El Monte. On the federal level, California's Tennessee-born Senator William Gwin supported the South's secession, as did the state's all-Democratic House delegation. Strategists in Confederate Texas hoped to reach California by an invasion corridor through the New Mexico Territory, and Texas cavalry did get as far as Tucson. Indeed, a new territory of Arizona, spanning the invasion corridor and with Tucson as its capital, was claimed as part of the Confederacy in 1861. Another soon-to-be-admitted state, Kansas, teetered for a while in the late 1850s as northern emigrants vied with pro-slavery forces from adjacent Missouri to pass a suitable constitution. The first version, the so-called Lecompton Constitution, favorable to slavery, was accepted by President James Buchanan but disdained by Congress because of fraud. A second popular vote, held in 1858, rejected the pro-slavery agreement, 13,088 to 11,300. Finally, in 1861, after secession, when Southern senators and representatives had gone home, the new Northern Congress admitted Kansas as a free state. The last group of eventual states caught up in the western side currents of the Civil War held only territorial status at the time: Colorado, Utah, Nevada, Idaho, and Montana. Utah was Democratic-leaning, hostile to New Englanders who damned its controlling Mormons for their pro-slavery and polygamist inclinations. Elsewhere in the Rocky Mountains, immigrants by the tens of thousands clumped around the only destinations lucrative enough to outweigh Indian perils: rich veins of gold, silver, copper, and lead. The 1850s had seen gold strikes in Oregon, and 1859 brought a bigger one in Colorado, centered on Denver. More rich lodes were found in 1860 in Idaho's Clearwater and Salmon Valleys, followed by even richer ones in western Montana, where creeks such as Grasshopper, Stinking Water, and Alder Gulch became legendary and notorious. In 1863, the 17-mile length of Alder Gulch's gravel bars was reported to have 10,000 miners, and on its steep banks were four cities with names famous in mining history: Virginia, Nevada, Central, and Summit. Besides gold and silver, a further opportunity lay in fleeing the hazards of Bull Run, Shiloh, and Antietam. The mining camps had their Unionists, but they also had their Southern sympathizers, and Democrats were in the majority. Many miners from both sides in the Civil War had come to the mines to escape military conscription, but they gallantly defended their homelands and causes with toasts, torchlight parades, and fistfights on Saturday night. So substantial were the numbers that the governor of Iowa called for patrols at the Missouri River crossings to catch evaders fleeing west. Although the western territories were under nominal Washington control, law enforcement was slack, especially in the rowdy mining camps. During the war, wrote historian Earl Pomeroy, the Lincoln administration treated the Far West as tactfully as it had treated the border states early in 1861. The president never applied the draft west of Iowa and Kansas, apparently considering that it was not expedient to draw more men from the West Coast than had volunteered. The Army feared it would waste its strength tracking draft dodgers and deserters through the backcountry, and Western businessmen repeatedly expressed fear of secessionist uprisings. Montana and Idaho, part of Washington Territory until 1863, and Colorado had large southern populations. Virginia City, in present-day Montana, had at first been called Verena City, after Jefferson Davis's wife, but a local judge changed the name. Other sites included Dixie, Fort Sumter, and Confederate Gulch, the mining center of the Big Belt Mountains. By one estimate, nearly 80% of the population had secessionist sympathies, and Republicans in the territorial administration brought in wagon trains of emigrants from St. Paul, Minnesota, to help maintain control. One particular fear was of plots to ship gold to the South. In Colorado, Republican Governor William Gilpin, charged with keeping Colorado loyal to the Union, wrote to authorities in Washington that 7,500 people, almost one-third of the population of Denver and the mining camps, were Confederate sympathizers. In addition, noted historian Alvin Josephi in the Civil War in the American West, Colorado was stirred constantly by reports of pro-Confederate plots, many of them real. Several well-known Southern sympathizers organized bands of followers to try to join the Confederates in Texas. Still another group of secessionists congregated secretly at Mace's Hole, a hideout south of the Arkansas River, and tried to organize themselves into a Confederate regiment. Had the Confederate troops won at La Glorieta Pass in 1862, they might have continued on to the Colorado gold fields. Josephi's book probes one of the least known and most fascinating sidebars to the general history of the Civil War. However, the current-day reason to underscore how portions of the early West mixed northern and southern politics and population strains is that in many important ways, substantial born-again evangelicalism or fundamentalism, sectarian rather than mainline religion, political conservatism, and cultural individualism, the blending is ongoing. Responding to many different lures, Southerners and Southern inclinations and affinities continued to move westward during the late 19th and 20th centuries. Indeed, mining was the original draw for some Southerners, because the Dahlonega District of northern Georgia held the nation's best producing gold fields at the period prior to the California Gold Rush. At its peak in the 1830s, 15,000 miners were on hand there. By the 40s and 50s, they were looking for new opportunities. Indeed, Georgians from Dahlonega, meaning yellow money in Cherokee, discovered the gold in both the Cherry Creek and Leadville districts of Colorado. In Montana, Georgians striking it rich named Last Chance Gulch near Helena, and another, John Bozeman, blazed the trail bearing his name to the Montana goldfields. After 1865, Southerners took jobs not only in mining, but on the transcontinental railroads. Enough worked on the Union Pacific as it crossed Wyoming in 1867 to keep the pro-Confederate Frontier Index popular as the railroad's house organ. But the preeminent influx by the late 1860s and 1870s came with the cattle drives, mostly north from Texas, following the Chisholm, Goodnight Loving, Great Western, and other trails into Kansas, Nebraska, Montana, and Wyoming. These movements brought the cattle culture not just to the railheads, but into valleys near the Oregon Trail and the mountain pastures of the Rockies. Texans and Missourians came too. According to one regional history, many men who came up the Texas Trail to Montana during the great years of the Long Drive brought with them both longhorn cattle and their political allegiances. By the mid-1870s, Montana ranges were being grazed by once southern cattlemen all the way to the Canadian border. The Oregon Trail itself kept bringing Missourians to the Rockies and the Pacific Northwest. After 1863, pro-secessionists from a strip of western Missouri counties, put under martial law because of guerrilla strife and northern retribution, began heading west in large numbers. Of roughly 40,000 emigrants traveling west on the Platte River Road in 1864, about half were Missourians, many of them Confederate sympathizers. At the trail's end, draft dodgers and Missouri Democrats were conspicuous enough to make one Republican remark that the left wing of Missouri Confederate General Sterling Price's army was still encamped in the eastern part of Oregon, and that the Oregon Democracy generally were only a step removed from Price and Jefferson Davis. Within another decade, many Oregonians were joining the Southern Alliance, an agrarian radical group that operated through secret societies, excluded blacks, and used Klan-like rituals and paraphernalia. Toward the end of the 19th century, as the timber business began to migrate west to the spruce, cedar, ponderosa pine, and Douglas fir forests of the Pacific Northwest, eastern loggers came along. A substantial immigration from the southern Appalachian Mountains into the northwestern lumber districts had begun in the 1880s, reinforcing the southern and border stock of the earlier years. Logging centers in southwestern Oregon, Idaho, and Washington State were favored destinations. The 20th century saw the extension of the movement. Missouri and Texas became the second and third ranking states in number of migrants sent to California during the 1920s, and these inflows continued during the 1930s alongside Oklahoma and Kansas residents fleeing parched farms in the Dust Bowl. Giant federal works projects such as the Grand Coulee, Bonneville, Fort Peck, and Hoover Dams also beckoned the unemployed westward, as did the war industries and military installations that ballooned between 1941 and 1945. In Dixie Rising, Peter Applebaum profiled the huge migration out of the South between 1910 and 1960. Besides 4.5 million blacks, mostly bound for the urban North, some 4.6 million whites also left the South, principally for the Midwest and the West. So many Kentuckians, West Virginians, and Tennesseans went northward to the automobile and rubber plants of the Great Lakes states that most factory cities had their hillbilly hollows and little West Virginias. Ypsilanti, Michigan, close by Ford's huge Willow Run facility, was known as Ipsitucky. In Ohio, Dayton and Columbus had Appalachian neighborhoods, but the fiddle and revival capital was rubber-making Akron. In 1940, the Ohio Guide noted that over 60% of its people were of Southern origin. Plants in southern Ohio brought in large numbers of strikebreakers from the Tennessee and Kentucky mountains, who grouped together in shanty towns named Happy Top and Gobbler's Knob. Along the Pacific and in the Rocky Mountain states, chroniclers of the emigration from below the Mason-Dixon line generally emphasized the huge draw of the 1941 to 1945 war industries and military installations. From Puget Sound, San Diego, Phoenix, and Los Alamos, the histories of local SBC area associations typically mention the southern-bred population influx that began after Pearl Harbor. The tale of this demographic extension of the South has been told elsewhere, although perhaps without the detail that befits a discussion of the consequences for early 21st century U.S. politics. We must now turn to a less discussed but related corollary, the piggybacked extension of Southern culture and evangelical, fundamentalist, and Pentecostal religion. The historical myth-making of the Lost Cause did not simply intensify Southern and border state memories. It also recast them. States where most men serving in Civil War armies had fought for the Union, Maryland, Kentucky, and Missouri, wound up with a disproportion of Southern memorials and museums. James Loewen profiled this Confederate Reconquista in his book Lies Across America, which describes inaccurate historical sites. What the Confederates did not win on the 1861 to 1865 battlefields, they achieved on historical markers and the inscriptions on veterans' memorials. Tributes to the Boys in Gray turned up as far north as Helena, Montana, while Kentucky, a state that sent 90,000 soldiers to Union armies and just 35,000 to Southern units, wound up with 72 Confederate monuments, compared with just 2 for the Union side. The Confederate monument in Montana, put up by the Daughters of the Army of the Confederacy in 1916, commemorates the Southerners of Last Chance Gulch, now Helena's main street. Perhaps these unsung heroes smuggled more gold back to the South than historians believe. The proliferation of Southern religion, however, greatly exceeded that of Confederate memorials. By the 1930s, the SBC missionary effort in the West had begun, and the migrations from the South during World War II provided a major boost. A later history, Southern Baptists in the Intermountain West credited the buildup of military bases and war industries, noting that between 1940 and 1974, SBC Western membership grew from two small state conventions in New Mexico and Arizona to